Picture this. It's past midnight on May 17, 1943. Somewhere over the dark valleys of the Ruhr in occupied Germany, a Lancaster bomber is flying lower than most people's rooftops, 60 feet above a reservoir. The pilot isn't trusting his altimeter at this height and speed. He's watching two spotlights mounted on the belly of his aircraft. When those two beams converge on the black water below into a single oval of light, he's at exactly 60 feet too high, and the weapon fails, too low, and the shockwave from detonation pulls the airplane into the water. There's maybe a 30-foot margin between doing this right and dying. I'm Tail Dragger, this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Tonight, we're going back to one of the most audacious missions ever flown. The kind of mission where the aircraft, the weapon, the crew, and the mathematics all had to work perfectly at the same moment, over a defended target, at night, for the first and only time anyone had ever tried it. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. To understand Operation Chastise, the official name for what the world would come to call the Dambusters raid, you have to start with a man named Barnes Wallace. Wallace wasn't a pilot, he was a structural engineer, and by 1942 he was already credited with designing the geodetic airframe that made the Vickers Wellington bomber so extraordinarily tough. You could shoot great chunks out of a Wellington and it would still get the crew home. That was Wallace's work, but his mind had moved on to something much bigger. He believed that if you could destroy the great dams of the Ruhr Valley, you could strangle Germany's industrial heartland. The Ruhr was where the steel was smelted, where the ammunition was forged, where the tanks and artillery pieces and shell casings came from. The dams held the water that cooled the furnaces and the power that ran the machinery. Without them, the Ruhr couldn't function, and the dams had never been built to withstand a direct hit from underneath the waterline. The problem was getting a weapon there. A conventional bomb dropped from altitude would miss or tumble. Even a direct hit on the surface of the reservoir would skip wide and not detonate where it needed to. Torpedoes couldn't get through the anti-torpedo netting strung across the face of every major dam. There was no obvious answer. Wallace went back to something very old. He thought about how boys skip stones across a pond. He had read accounts of naval battles where gun crews deliberately skipped cannonballs across the surface of the water to strike enemy hulls below the waterline. He thought about backspin. A stone thrown with the right backward rotation doesn't just skim, it grips the water and bounces in a predictable arc. What if you gave a bomb enough backspin that it would do the same? Skip over the torpedo nets, roll down the curved face of the dam, settle against the base, and detonate where the hydrostatic pressure would amplify the blast into the foundation itself. He ran experiments with spheres in a tank. He worked with the National Physical Laboratory. He dropped test shapes off a dam in Kent. He wrote memos and attended meetings and made enemies in Whitehall, because he kept pushing an idea that too many officials thought was nonsense. At one point, a senior air ministry man told Wallace to his face that the whole concept was, quote, tripe, but the physics kept working, and eventually the brass gave him just enough rope to either hang himself or pull off something impossible. The weapon that emerged, codenamed Upkeep, was not the tidy sphere Wallace had originally envisioned. The final design was cylindrical, about 5 feet long, 4 feet in diameter, roughly 9,500 pounds loaded. Before release, it had to be spun up to 500 revolutions per minute in the backwards direction, driven by a belt system powered off the Lancaster's own hydraulics. You could hear it spinning in the bomb bay, a deep mechanical whine on top of the roar of the Merlin engines. The aircraft had to approach the target at exactly 220 miles per hour, at exactly 60 feet, and release from exactly 450 yards out. If any of those numbers were off by much, the geometry of the bounce went wrong. The bomb either skipped over the dam entirely or plunged too early. Now here's where it gets interesting. The 60-foot problem was solved with those spotlights, two lamps mounted under the fuselage, angled so their cones crossed at exactly 60 feet below the aircraft. When the pilot saw the single figure eight of merged light on the water beneath him, he was at altitude, not close to it. At it. Simple, ingenious, and invented because the conventional instruments couldn't do the job. The ranging problem, knowing precisely when the aircraft was 450 yards from the dam wall, was solved by a wooden Y-shaped sight finder that probably cost less to make than the average pilot's watch. The Mona Dam, the primary target, had two towers rising from its crest. When those towers lined up exactly with the notched prongs of the wooden frame, the bomb aimer was at 450 yards. He dropped. Low-tech doesn't begin to cover it, but it worked. To fly the mission, the Royal Air Force assembled an entirely new unit. 617 Squadron, formed in March of 1943, they pulled experienced crews from frontline bomber groups, men who had already flown tours over Germany, men who had already seen what defending flak and night fighters could do. They were told almost nothing about what they were training for, just that they needed to get very good at flying very low at night over water.
They practiced over reservoirs in the English Midlands, 60 feet in daylight until it felt like nothing. Then 60 feet at night until the darkness stopped feeling like a threat and started feeling like cover. Some crews found the low flying exhilarating. Others found it quietly terrifying. The sound of a Lancaster at 60 feet over water is not a comfortable sound. The engines are working hard, you can feel the ground effect, and if you let the nose drop even a few degrees, there's no altitude margin to recover. The man who commanded 617 Squadron was Wing Commander Guy Gibson. He was 24 years old. He had already completed a full tour on bombers and a second tour on night fighters. He had more combat hours than officers who outranked him by several grades. He was demanding and exacting and entirely without sentiment about the standard he expected. Some of his airmen found him cold. All of them respected the fact that he had done this before. The mission launched the evening of May 16, 1943. 19 Lancasters in three waves flying low across the North Sea after dark, crossing into occupied Holland below the level of German radar, navigating by rivers and canal systems and railway lines in blackout conditions. It was a fundamentally different kind of flying from what these men had been trained for. Bomber crews flew high in tight defensive formations. This was the opposite of everything they knew. Two aircraft were lost before they even reached the dams. One clipped high-tension wires crossing a Dutch river estuary. Another took damage and turned back. The rest pressed on toward the Ruhr. Gibson led the first wave to the Mone Reservoir. The valley was dark, the water in the reservoir lay still and black behind the dam. And then the flak opened up. Anti-aircraft guns on the dam towers and along the crest, firing nearly horizontally at aircraft coming in at 60 feet. Gibson made the first attack run himself. He pulled ahead of his formation, descended to the lights, ran in across the water with the gunners shooting at him to draw their attention while the trailing aircraft set up behind him. His bomb hit, the Mone Dam shuddered, but it held.
A second aircraft attacked. A third. Another Lancaster was shot down on approach, falling in flames into the reservoir itself. Another made it through but came out trailing fire on the fifth attack. Flown by Flight Lieutenant David Maltby, the dam broke. Millions of cubic feet of water came roaring through a gap more than 200 feet wide. The sound, by all accounts from those who heard it, was immense. The water went down the valley in a wall. Gibson radioed back to base a pre-arranged code word, confirming the breach. It was the name of his black Labrador, killed on the road outside the airfield that same afternoon. He had given orders for the dog to be buried at midnight, the hour he expected to be over the target. Then he led what remained of the first wave onto the Eder Dam. The Eder was harder. It sat in a steep-sided valley with hills on the approach that demanded an almost diving turn on final before leveling at 60 feet. The run-in was shorter, the margins tighter. It took several passes, but the Eder went too. The third primary target, the Sorp Dam, was attacked by a separate wave and damaged, but not breached. The Sorp was earthen construction rather than concrete. And the bouncing bomb wasn't optimized for it, it was the one that got away. By the time the survivors turned for home, the cost was known. 8 of the 19 Lancasters did not return. 53 aircrew killed, 3 taken prisoner. Of the 133 men who flew that night, roughly half became casualties. 617 Squadron had been operational for less than 6 weeks. The flooding downstream killed approximately 1,600 people in the valleys below the dams. Most of them were not German civilians. Most were foreign forced laborers, Ukrainian and Soviet workers held in camps near the water. That part of the story was not well told at the time. The strategic result was real, but disputed. German engineers repaired both dams by September, faster than anyone in London had expected. The Ruhr was disrupted, not destroyed. The war machine adjusted and kept running.
But what the raid proved was something harder to measure and ultimately more durable. It proved that a small, precisely trained force with the exactly right weapon could accomplish what massed formations could not. 617 Squadron went on to carry Barnes Wallace's later inventions. The Tallboy, and then the Grand Slam, the largest conventional bomb used by any air force in the war. They attacked reinforced submarine pens, viaducts, V-weapon sites, and eventually the German battleship Tirpitz. They became the Royal Air Force's elite precision strike unit. All of it grew from a wooden rangefinder and a pair of spotlights and one stubborn engineer who refused to accept that it couldn't be done.
Guy Gibson received the Victoria Cross for his leadership that night. He went on flying. He was killed in September of 1944 over Germany, piloting a Mosquito on his way home from a raid. He was 26 years old. Some men, it seems, just can't stay on the ground. Paul Brickhill's account, simply titled The Dam Busters and published in 1951, remains the finest popular telling of this story. John Sweetman's more recent The Dam Busters Raid has the operational detail for anyone who wants to go deeper. More at radiohanger.com, 60 feet. That's where they flew it. See you next time.